Good afternoon. It is a Thursday, September the 27th, 2018, 14 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program, and over the next 2 hours, we're going to have a good time because we're going to be chatting with Jim Albright, who was the last guard out of Alcatraz prison. Now remember, Jim will be at Harding High School tonight at 7 p.m. Giving a lecture, pictures, stories from his years at Alcatraz prison. Now the important thing to remember about this event is absolutely free to the public, Harding High School tonight at 7 p.m. So we are so glad to welcome Jim and his wife Kathy to the studio today. Jim, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yes, good to speak with you. Jim, I wanted to talk a little bit about your years at Alcatraz. I know Charlie covered some of this morning, but when did you start there?
I started there August 24th of 1959.
And when you first walked in, what did you think?
What the hell am I doing here?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it had that reputation then.
Yeah, exactly.
Why do you think it had this reputation?
As I told Charlie, the news reporters, news staff, news people were never allowed on the island. And so they actually built a mystique. You know, each one had their own idea of what's going on over there and what they thought. And of course, they liked to embellish all their stories. And it just a reputation that grew throughout the years. And even inmates that had been there before and they come back, they would have stories they would tell the other inmates. And as a new inmate comes in, the old inmates are telling them stories. And it's just something that built and grew over the years.
So what is the truth behind Alcatraz? What was it like to be there if you were a prisoner?
Actually, after I was there and got my feet on the ground and settled in, it was just another job. I got up and walked up the hill and went to work every day. And when I was done, I walked back down the hill to our apartment. You did the same thing at the same time every day. Every day it just went over and over and over. It almost got to the point it was boring. And then if something happened, then it got very exciting.
Was there ever a fear while you were there?
No. Apprehension, maybe, but I don't think it was really fear.
Were there inmates who the guards did not want to particularly deal with?
There were some that were the PIA type. I tried to treat everybody the same. And as I told Charlie, I tried to treat them how I thought I should be treated had I been the one doing the time in there. And they used to be guards that would, what I called, spin them. You would ask them a question, and they'd say, "I don't know, but I'll find out and I'll get back to you." Well, that would be the end of it. And I picked up on that, and if an inmate asked me a question I didn't know, I'd say, "I don't know, I'll find out, and I'll get back to you." And I made it a point to find out and get back. They may not like the answer I give them, but they appreciated me finding out.
What kind of questions did they have?
Oh, sometimes just simple little things, you know, or... Do you know that if we're going to get a steak this week? You know, I don't know anything about the kitchen. You know, I don't know what the menu is. I don't bother reading it. But I could go read it and find out. They could go read it and find out. They would file lawsuits over nothing. I mean, and they still do that today, the inmates do in the prisons around here, I'm sure. Even though I haven't been in a prison 30 years, you know. He got bigger egg than I did, you know. And you know, just things like that.
Do you think there was a lot of fear of inmates by other inmates?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, because as I told Charlie, that normal prison, you'll have fist fights. You know, we had them once in a while, not very often. But out there, we had the worst of the worst from a lot of different prisons that were sent there. And so everybody had to be a tough guy, and you had to put on a front. So that meant if you get into a beef with somebody, you're going to try and stab them.
How do the guards avoid issues like that, stabbings, problems?
Well, you tried to shake down as much as you could and looking, you know, to find that type of stuff. But we were short of staff, and it only goes so far, you know. We were so short of staff at one time, I was working all of my days off. And it's kind of comical. I had worked like 5 or 6 weeks in a row without a day off. And I come home on my Friday night, and I went and I told Kathy, I says, if that phone rings and they want me to go back to work, I ain't here. Mm. And she looked at me and she says, you live on an island.
Hard to get away. Hard to get away. When you were there, did you ever get stir crazy thinking, I want to go somewhere?
No.
No?
No, I have a copy of our boat schedule in our book, and it shows the boat leaving from Alcatraz and then coming back from Fort Mason. That's where we docked when we lived there, was Fort Mason. And any time you was off duty, you could go to town or go. And we used to go like to Muir Woods, Stinson Beach, and places like that on the days off. And it was another thing kind of comical. At that time, when we was kind of poor, and we would take a quarter out of your pocket where the money you would spend and put it in a different pocket. And then we'd go up to Muir Woods or Stinson Beach or whatever it was. And that way, when we come back to go across the Golden Gate Bridge, we had a quarter for the toll to get back home. Yeah. Now it's $7 and something.
Wow.
For that.
Wow. Yeah. When you go back, you were just back recently.
We've been back twice this year.
Twice this year. What's it like to go back?
Mixed emotions. Because you see the damage from the Indian occupation where they burnt buildings and things like that. And you get off the boat, you're like a sponge. You're soaking everything up and seeing the building that we used to live in and the prison, of course, and some of the other buildings that are still standing. And then you see buildings that are not standing. You see the remnants of it. And the social hall and the warden's house is just a shell, and they had to put braces in there to hold them up so they wouldn't fall in. And that kind of tears at your heart, because when we was there, it was like an army post. Everything was pristine. All the flowers stood at attention at the same height, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it was really, really nice. And you're seeing the opposite now. And like she had mentioned earlier this morning, that somebody would say they'd see the island the way it is now and say, you live there? But they didn't see it the way it was when we lived there.
What was on the island when you were there? Were there things you could do?
Okay, we had our own little church. We had a little store where you could buy staples. We had a post office with our own postmark. We had a social hall, and in there they had place for dinners, dances, stage plays. They had movie projectors. I learned to run the movie projectors, and whatever inmates seen for Saturday and Sunday movie, I'd show the island residents on Sunday night. In the lower level of that building, we had ping pong, pool, library, snack bar, and two-lane bowling alley. Mm. And we used to have little bowling tournament leagues.
For somebody who has never been there, how big is the island?
That's a question in my mind, because there's a sign as you get off the dock, and it says 12 and a half acres. And that's what I learned it as, was 12 and a half acres. But I've seen other writings that said 22 acres, and which one is right? You know, I go with the 12 and a half acres because that's what I learned, and that's what says on the dock.
So many people go and visit. I think there is a waiting list if you try to sign up to go.
Correct. When we was out there this past August, in March, I don't remember in March, but in August, there was a sign on the dock where you get on the boat that the next available trip was 3 weeks away.
It depends upon the time of the year that you go there, whether there's a waiting list or not.
What do you think makes it, to this day, such an attraction?
The mystique throughout the years, like the papers, story. Some of them are responsible, and reporters was never allowed on the island. The very last day, March 21st of 1963, there was like 300 news people on the island. I mean, everywhere you turned, you bumped into one. You
know? Why were reporters not allowed on the island?
They didn't let them have any contact with the inmates. And I think that was part of the mystique. You know, if you wanted to go over there and they say, no, we don't allow reporters, then you're going to write something, but you're going to write it from your frame of mind, and it's not going to be a good frame of mind because you weren't allowed to go.
So the people there who were running it wanted it to have that mystique.
I think they might have, yeah. And that started way back with Warden Johnston when he was the first warden and really making it tough, you know.
Now, what did you have to do as a prisoner to get there?
You had to mess up in another prison. There's a sign there on the island that says if you break the rules, you go to prison. If you break the prison rules, you go to Alcatraz. Mm. And we had a couple of state prisoners that the state would pay the government to care for. And one of them was from Sing Sing, New York, and he had led a riot at Sing Sing. And so that was why they sent him to us.
You know, interestingly enough, I mean, a lot of famous people went through Alcatraz. Now, obviously, Al Capone was before your time. But were there any prisoners or guards there when you came that remembered his time there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. See, I was 24 when I went there. A lot of the guys when I was there, they were old men. They were 40. When you're 24, 40's an old man.
I'm a little older.
and they knew him. Yeah, they knew him. Like Alvin Karpus was still there while I was there. He did more time on the island than any other inmate. He did over 25 years right there on the island.
I heard you talking with Charlie earlier on about the Birdman. Now, he was there, Robert Stroud, when you were there. What was his demeanor like?
He was not liked by inmates nor officers. He was a nasty, nasty person. When I went to Marion, Illinois, when they closed the island, they sent me to Marion, and one of the inmates at Marion come out about 3 o'clock in the morning and is asking me about Stroud. And he said he was the inmate orderly in the segregation at the medical center where Stroud was sent. And he said he was a no good SOB and very degenerate person. I said, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And he said, when I was serving him his meals, he would always ask me for a raw hamburger and raw meat and stuff like that. And then one time I served it and he grabbed my arm and he said, did you ever eat anybody? And I asked him, I said, what'd you tell him? He said, I said, no. And Stroud said, no, I don't mean like that. He says, I mean physically, like Jeffrey Dahmer did, eat them physically. And I mean, he was just a nasty person.
Was there ever fear of him when you were there, being this nasty person?
No, because he was always kept in isolation. Yeah.
When the movie came out, I believe it was 1962, Birdman of Alcatraz. What did you ever see the movie?
I've seen it.
What did you think about it?
Burt Lancaster. Yeah, and they made Stroud out to be a hero in that movie. That's when he was there for the 46 riot, and they were bombing the segregation, and he went down and closed the cell door so the stuff wouldn't get in there and get the inmate was in there. And in fact, Burt Lancaster kind of went to bat saying, you know, maybe he should be paroled and blah, blah, blah. And then he really got to know him as they're working together throughout making the movie. And then he dropped him like a hot potato and didn't want nothing to do with him.
Why do you think he was the one that the movie was made about? Why was he so appealing to somebody like a Burt Lancaster?
Well, because the movie they thought would sell. And he did. He did learn a lot about birds. He was very good with birds. But he did a lot of plagiarism, too.
Mm. Now, when it comes to people there, like Mickey Cohn, Machine Gun Kelly, were there stories that you heard of them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you heard stories about everybody, you know. And everybody wants to be famous, you know, and everybody's got to brag. And that's the thing that surprises me about the three that they never found that escaped. They'd had to brag because they were braggers. All three of them were.
You knew them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, John, the older brother, worked for me in the clothing room.
What happened that day that all went down?
Well, I can't tell you that much about it because I was working the clothing room when John worked for me down there, and I was not due in until 9 o'clock. I was still in bed. And the alarm went off about 7:15, and I jumped up. When I hit the floor, I was dressed, and I grabbed my crutches. I'd been over town the night before playing ball, and I stepped in a hole and twisted my knee, and I went to the hospital, and they gave me crutches. And so I'm crutching up the hill, and I run into a lieutenant, and I said, "What's up?" And he says, "I don't know. I just heard that we got some missing." He says, "You go watch the back of the cell house." So I went to the back of the cell house, and I was watching it. We didn't know if they was just going or what, you know. And throughout the course of the morning, I heard who had went. Well, a small population, and I'd worked the clothing room for almost a year, so I knew everybody's name, number, where they sold, where they worked, and what size clothes they wore. And so I'd heard who went. And when I got relieved for lunch, I went inside. I didn't go to lunch. I wanted to see what's going on, you know. And I stepped up to the cell, and this is at noon, and all the inmates are laying in, of course. And when I stepped up to the cell, that dummy head was so real that I moved to the next cell. I thought I'd made a mistake. You know?
How do you think that was possible, that they were able to create such lifelike dummies?
They had... different people advising them, you know, how to do this and how to do that. And Morris was a very intelligent person, very intelligent. The two brothers weren't that smart of guys, you know. They were just average. And I think between the help they had and his intelligence, and then we were short of help because they was closing, and you couldn't go do your job and shake down. You didn't have time. When I first went there, I used to crawl every window in that cell house and beat them with a hammer, because if they'd been cut, they'd make a different ring, and you'd be able to recognize it. And then we used to go and shake down all the cells, and we couldn't do that anymore. Mm. So actually, I lay that back to Bobby Kennedy. He cut us down, you know, and he closed it. And had he not cut us down, we could have had the security.
Now, the story was, for those who don't remember, that they had created a raft and went into the river and possibly got across. Was there ever a thought that they did make it in those early days?
Yeah, some people questioned it. Kathy told Charlie, we seen a movie last night on the History Channel, and it shows the raft over on Angel Island. Supposedly they went that way, you know. According to their cousins, they stole the extension cords and they tied them around the shaft on the boat, and they held on to the cord and the boat towed them over to town, you know. And so there's all kinds of theories and ideas. Mine is they didn't make it, you know, because they'd have had to brag to somebody throughout the years. And my contention is they were bank robbers. They weren't killers. And had I been one of them, and I'm gone 3, 4, 5 years, and I'm not caught, I'm going to turn myself in. Then you'd be on Jay Leno's show and the Oprah show and Today's show. You'd have personal appearances and movies and books. You wouldn't have time to count your money.
Why do you think bank robbers, who would not have been there for life, attempted this?
I think some of it's an ego thing. I got to show these other guys that I can get out of this. I can beat this place, you know.
But it would have been a pretty miserable death out there in the ocean. Ooh.
Well, they had, I think, 16 attempts. I don't know where there was 30-some people. I don't remember the figures anymore. But there's 5 they never found, them 3 and 2 others they never found. And 2 of them, it was a very foggy day when they went, and they were being shot at as they're running into the fog. So were they shot and just drowned and floated away, or did they make it, or, you know, nobody knows.
Do you think it would have been possible to escape being surrounded by water?
The water was very, very swift and very, very cold, so you had about a half hour, and then your senses are starting to shut down. So it was awfully tough, unless you had help. And unless you had a boat there to pick you up or something, you know, it'd have been tough. When we were out there 1 year, we were at a restaurant eating, and our waiter, we got to talking to him, and he was going to swim it the next day. He was in a swim club. And as I told him, it's a lot different when you're trained for it and you can go out there and swim in that cool water, or that cold water, I should say, and you can grease yourself up, or you can have a wetsuit and you have a boat spotting you, than it is if you're sneaking out at night and having somebody shoot at you.
Yeah, I would imagine. Is there a camaraderie among the guards?
It was like a family. Everybody kind of pulled together, and you didn't want to be at odds with somebody because your life might depend on them tomorrow.
Yeah,
you know. So
you go back, and some of the prisoners are there. Is there a camaraderie there?
When we was there in August, Bill Baker was there. He's an ex-convict there. And they interviewed us together. And he went so far as he put his arm around my shoulder and was telling nice things about me.
Did you know of guards who were not doing as they should have?
There's always bad in every crowd. It don't make any difference where you are. And we had 1 or 2 that should have had a different line of work.
Yeah. What, in those situations, what do you do when you see that happening?
Well, there's not much you can do, you know. You tell officials, you know, that this guy is not doing what he should, or what I didn't learn that way, you know. When I went there, I kind of watched everybody, and I picked out 3 guys that I thought were the good officers, and I tried to model myself after them. And it must have worked, because I was there 4 years, and I got 2 promotions in 4 years, so I figured it worked.
What is the job of a good officer?
Safety and security of an inmates. Yeah, that's your primary duty, And everybody, no matter what your job is there, I don't care if you're the warden or the business manager or the trash collector, your job is the safety and security of the inmates.
I heard you mention during Charlie's show that some of the inmates did not want to leave when the prison closed. Well, why was that?
Well, when they were at Alcatraz, they were in single-man cells, and everybody there was a tough guy. Everybody was a tough guy, regardless of whether you were or not. So everybody had that little bit of fear from each other and for each other. And plus, when you get transferred from there, am I going to a place where they have cubicles? Am I going to a place where they have 10-man cells? You know, there was a lot of fear there. Some of them actually, you know, were nasty and run their mouths, but they get in their cell at night and they know that nobody's going to get on them till in the morning. You know, I'm safe.
Did the prisoners have a decent life who were there?
Oh, yeah.
Because we always hear stories about other prisons. You know, the food's not good, the treatment's not good.
Our food was the best in the prison service. And good food keeps trouble down.
Yeah, we think
so. One of their jobs when you was dock of patrolman at night, maybe at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're patrolling the island. And as you patrol, like, the East Beach, or down behind the industries building on the other end of the island, you see the striped bass, the fish running. You go back to the dock, and there's a list on the wall in the dock of these people that are up in their apartment sound asleep, but they weren't called when you see the fish running. And so you call them, and you make another round, and you go down there where the fish are at, and there could be anywhere from 10 to 30 people down there fishing. And they would catch them fish, and they made a little trough that they could hook a hose to, and they'd lay them on there, and they would fillet them out and let the rest of the fish go into the water. And sometimes it would hit the water. Most of the times the gulls would have it before it ever hit the water. And then you could go down, anybody that lived on the island could go down, take all the fish they wanted, and the fish that was left over, they'd go up and they'd give it to the cook, and he'd feed the mainline with it, and the inmates loved it. And they always looked forward to the fish running so they could have a fish feast. Mm. And then that let him take his budget farther. And then he could throw in a steak somewhere down the line, and they'd have another big meal.
You talked about showing movies to the inmates. What kind of pictures do you remember?
Shirley Temple. And they were them type of movies. They didn't have a lot of gangbang shoot 'em ups and things like that. You know.
Did the inmates like those type of movies?
It depended on the weather. If it was a very nice sunny day, they'd go to the yard. And your movie attendance would be way down. If it was a nasty rainy day, then you'd have a big movie attendance.
What would a prisoner at Alcatraz have to do from the time they got up to the time they went to bed? What's their day like?
Well, they'd have the 7 o'clock whistle or bell. The man in the West Gun Gallery would ring a bell. The lieutenant would signal him, and he'd ring a bell, and that would wake him up. And then they had so many minutes to get cleaned up and shave and get ready to go to breakfast and get dressed and everything, make their bed. And then they'd, when the kitchen was ready, they'd ring a bell. He'd signal the gun gallery, and the man would ring a bell, and they'd yell breakfast. And then they would open, like we had B1, B2, B3, inside would be 1, 2, 3, outside, same thing, and C block. And they alternated every time. And the lieutenant would signal you, and you'd open them cells, and they would step out, and they'd have fully dressed, every button, shoes laced up and tied, pants up around their waist with their shirt tucked in and their belt cinched. And they would march quietly to chow. And you did that till you got them all in the cell or in the chow hall. Once they were all in, the lieutenant would and got their meals and sit down at their tables. The lieutenant would signal you, and then you would start unseating them. And we had 10-man tables, and you would stand at the end of the table. And when they got done, they put all their silverware right here in a certain place, and they put their cups in a certain place and their bowls and their tray. And then you would signal them, and they'd file out past you. And that way you could watch everything till they got past. Then you stepped to the next table and did it. And then they'd go back in, and you'd have a count. And when the count was clear, they would call work, and you'd open the cells, and they'd step out and go down the yard and line up on lines that they had for certain shops. And they'd line up on them lines and be counted. And they'd be counted by their crew supervisor. And then the lieutenant would call their crew out through the yard wall, and they'd go out. And the crew supervisor and the lieutenant stand on each side of the door and count them again. And then they'd go down to their shop, and they'd be counted. And then they'd work out the morning, and they'd be counted a couple times during the morning. And then they'd reverse that for coming in for the noon meal. And as they come from the industries up towards the yard wall at the bottom of the steps, there was a metal detector there, and they came through the metal detector, up the steps, through the yard, up the steps halfway in the yard, through another metal detector, up the rest of the stairs and into the cell house, through a portable metal detector, and then down to their cell, and then they'd be counted when it was all in.
Do you think, being in the prison system, that people can be reformed, or do people just end up coming back?
We had a lot of recidivism, but if they want to be reformed, they can be. It's strictly up to them. I know a half a dozen inmates that come back to our annual reunions, and all of them reform themselves, actually. We offered them the tools, and they have to pick them up and use them. And that's the same way with your prisons here. I'm sure that they have different programs, and they offer them different opportunities. But if you don't want to be reformed, they're not going to reform you.
Now, what kind of opportunities were offered?
Might be schooling. It could be. Like Jim Quillen, he became a x-ray technician, and they put him in the hospital and had him with a man that knew how, learned to do the x-rays.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. And with the people who just end up back there, what do you think the mind frame is, that it's okay to be there?
Yeah, it's okay to be there. And plus they have that little quirk that I can beat the system. We had a kid there, Red Hayes, and he was doing 99 years. And that was before I got there, before I started there. And through technicalities in the courts, he beat 90-some years of it. So he just did a very short time, and he got out. And he came back with 3 99s, 297 years, running consecutively. And I was working in clothing room when he come back, so I had to dress him into the prison. And he told me, he says, of course he came from Leavenworth, they transferred him from Leavenworth, and he says, you know, it's good to be back. He says, them guys at Leavenworth talking about going home, he says, I didn't want to hear that, I ain't going nowhere, you know. And he died in prison, naturally, but why would you do that if you had 99 years and then you come back with three times that much? You know, I mean, it just, they have that little quirk that they think they can beat the system.
When you would see the ex-convicts now, do you picture them back in those days? Does that run through your mind when you see them at the reunions?
No, we talk just like you and I are. Yeah.
Now, at the time, are you able to have that type of relationship with them?
Yeah, you talk with them and everything and pass the time of day you know, how are the Giants doing? Maybe they're a San Francisco Giant fan, you know, and things like that. But you just kept in the back of your mind, if I'm in the way, they're going to kill me, yeah. You know. So, and that was the thing when you first started, they said, you know, just talk to them, but don't get too close. You know, don't get close to them. And never give anything to nor accept anything from an inmate, because then they'll blackmail you. Mm-hmm.
So it gets that deep in there. Mm-hmm. What today, when people find out that you worked at Alcatraz, what's the response you get?
Well, when we actually were there and worked there, and you went over to town for something, and you had dealings with somebody in a store or something, and they had to know your address, and you would say Alcatraz Island, they backed up. They backed up from you, you know, like you were poison or something. Mm-hmm. You know? And now, when somebody finds out that we were at Alcatraz, it's questions.
Yeah.
A lot of questions.
How did the presentation start that you would give those?
I guess years ago, somebody somewhere heard that we was at Alcatraz. Could you come and talk to our group? And so we would write little notes and have little pieces of paper. And it would kind of be a guideline, you know. You'd be talking, and you'd look down to see, you know, what am I going to go to? What am I going to say? And then our granddaughter made a PowerPoint for us. We weren't capable, you know. That's that new electronic stuff. Yeah. But she made the PowerPoint for us. And after that, we went to Optimus, Kiwanis, whatever it was, the Breakfast Club, whatever it happened to be. And we give the talk there and the presentation. And then somebody would come up afterwards, and invariably there'd be always somebody come up and say, I belong to this group. Could you come and talk to them? And that just snowballed. And I think we've talked to every group in Terre Haute and the surrounding towns.
What is the most common question you get asked?
Well, when I'm on the island, and we go out there every August for the reunion, and we stayed a week after reunion, go to the island every day and sign books. Everybody that comes up, did you know Al Capone?
Yeah.
That was all the time. That's the, you know. And then they escape. Do you think them three guys made it? You know, that'll be the second question.
When you were watching the special last night, does it ever change your mind? Do you ever think, well, maybe they could have made it? Do you ever see any new information?
Yeah, they could have.
Yeah.
But then I also think back that they had two rafts. They made two rafts. They only took one because they left the other one for West, who was supposed to come and said he couldn't get out of his cell. I think he just got scared, you know, especially when he was left by himself. And so the three of them got on the raft. Were they too heavy for it then, with three of them instead of two? Did the two brothers kill Morris and drop him over to lighten the load? You know, there's the things you'll never know. Who was the body that the Norwegian freighter going out there in the Golden Gate Bridge that night, and he called the Coast Guard and said he seen a prison or a body floating dressed in prison garb? He didn't pick it up if he only would have. And by the time the Coast Guard got out there, it was gone. Who was that? You know, in the show last night, they thought it was Frank Morse, so they measured the bones and found out how tall he was, like 5'7½" or whatever it was. But it was just about the size maybe of John Anglin, too. Why didn't they check his DNA also, you know?
What's interesting, there are certain subjects, people long gone, that always remain. Elvis Presley, Marilyn Monroe.
Prince,
JFK assassination. All these things that are, and Alcatraz is one of them, even though now we've talked to guards, they've done the movies, we've seen the prisoners, people have talked to them, why does it maintain people? Can you come speak to my group?
Yeah. Well, everybody's curious about Alcatraz. Everybody has got a question about it. And if I come and talk to your group, and then you tell this lady, you know, he came and talked, and I said, that's very interesting, you know, you ought to get him for your group, you know, and that just snowballs.
Without giving away too much of tonight's presentation at 7 p.m., free again at the Harding High School, what are some things that are talked about, or pictures that are seen?
Well, it'll show our boat, you know, it'll show the building we used to live in. It'll show the cell house, and, you know, just different things like that, different shots around the island. It shows after the island was closed. I got a picture of her and the kids standing in front of the tower that's not there anymore. Mm. It's rusted away. It's completely gone.
Yeah. How long after Alcatraz closed did it become a destination for tourists?
God, it was several years because the, I think it was in the early 70s, because the Indians moved on there in 69, I believe, and they were there like 19 months. And it was after that before it ever happened.
Were you surprised when you started hearing that people were taking tours of the place?
Yeah, and at first we did not know that they had the annual reunions. It was 35 years from the day we left till we went back. Yeah, and then we get off the boat, and of course we're almost in tears seeing the damage that had been done and the buildings that had been burnt down. But and I was like a sponge, just stand back there, just soaking everything up, you know. And my sister and brother-in-law, who helped me with the book, they went up and told John Cantwell, the ranger that was speaking to the crowd, that I was there. And then he come out and says, Jim, he says, I'd like to take you on a personal tour. And, yeah, you have to twist my arm, you know. And so he took us on a 6.5-hour tour. I mean, he had keys to everything, and anywhere on that island I wanted to go, we went. And he remarked, we went up in the East Gun Gallery, and when we stepped in it, I says, oh, yeah, that's where them damn blankets were hanging, and that's where they went out through the ceiling. Everywhere we went, I remembered. And he says, Jim, he says, we've had a lot of people back here, but he says none of them remember the stuff you remember.
Why do you think it is so committed to your mind?
I don't know. I guess maybe the mystique of the place. I went there because I wanted a job with security and benefits and retirement, et cetera, and things like that. And I actually went from wanting a job to part of history now, and it wasn't planned, it just happened, you know. I didn't plan to be the last guard out. I didn't plan to escort the last inmate off the island, but it happened, you know.
How did that happen? How did you become the last guard out?
Well, that's kind of odd. Our youngest daughter was 11 days old the day the island closed. She was the last child born while it was still in operation. She was born with a foot deformity, and so we were taking her to Kaiser Hospital over town to get that corrected. So they left me there kind of like a caretaker so I'd have time to get that done. And so I actually stayed there, and we lived there from March 21st of 63, March 21st, 63, till June 22nd of 63. We was there 3 months after it closed.
Very interesting. We're discussing Alcatraz with the last guard out of Alcatraz, Jim Albright. We'll have Jim for one more hour here, and then tonight, don't forget to come to the Harding High School. It's absolutely free. Bring as many people as you like. Jim will be giving a presentation there starting at 7 p.m., Harding High School, right here on Route 309, Harding Highway, 7 p.m., open to the public. Doors will open at 6 p.m. You'll have copies of your book there, which will be great, and you can ask Jim questions. It'll be a lot of fun tonight to relive one of the most talked about certainly places in the history of the United States without question. And we should also mention that today's radio broadcast is supported by Sansoda's Fresh Italian, address 1292 Delaware Avenue, telephone number 740-751-6596. We're going to talk about why Alcatraz closed when we come back in our final hour, what the final days like were there for the prisons and Jim himself. Before we go, Jim, we have about 30 seconds before the break. Do you have any regrets when it comes to Alcatraz over the years, the times you've went back, the things you did there?
No, I don't think so. The biggest thing was is I hated to see it close. We were fearful when we went there, apprehensive when we went there, and very sad to see it close because we liked it, and I would not have left there had it not closed.
What was likable about it?
It was like a small town, you know, and you lived right where you worked. You didn't have to worry about the kids when they went out to play, you know. The biggest fear you had with the kids was if they fell off of the seawall, if they crawled up and fell off. Other than that, you didn't worry about them.
We're coming back with Jim Albright, the last guard out of Alcatraz, for another 40 minutes before we close our broadcast day after this 10-minute timeout for news.
Where it's quite evident that it's time for a change. Everything must change. If